Well, first, give me a fill-in about what you've been doing, other than writing and your other work in broadcasting.
Oh, well, I'm a news anchor man at the National Black Network. I've been anchoring there for about 12 years, freelance, and I just went on staff last August. And I've done a documentary since I've seen you called Saving the Black Family, which won an ACE Award and also won a SEBA Award. And basically, that's what I've been doing is writing. I've written 8 books so far, and this is the first book to be published, which I thought would be the last book to be published. But, you know, I'm glad to have that book out right now.
Yeah, I bet you are. Yeah, I was noticing here in your biography about all of the things you've been writing. And I know that you and I, over the years, have talked about, here they are, all this work. We've talked about your work and how frustrating it is and how difficult it is to get published and the mm-hmm. sense of rejection, and I felt the same way. Everybody I have talked to has that same feeling. Writing can be very satisfying when you mm-hmm. connect, mm-hmm. but don't you find it frustrating to do all this work and then get this continuous rejection?
Well, actually, I haven't had that much rejection. There was the first novel that I wrote was a romance novel, and I had submitted that to my agent, and she said I could write, and she did submit it to a couple of places, but it wasn't quite ready. The other books I've written, the other 8 books, 7 books that I've written, I haven't really tried to get them published yet. I wrote the books mainly because I had so much time on my hands and because I had so many ideas. So it had nothing to do with attempting to get published. My agent, Marie Brown, had suggested that I look into writing a Western, a black Western specifically, and at the same time I had the idea that a black Western might go over real well. And it so happens that an editor at Random House, Valentine Books, was looking for something like that. I put together a few ideas. And after sending it to Doubleday, and they rejected it, a few months later I sent it to Random House, and they were just ready for it. So they picked up the book, gave me a contract, and so there you have West of Paradise Run.
Well, I was talking to a writer named Valerie Martin last week, and she teaches writing at the University of Massachusetts. And one of the things she tells her students is, be prepared for rejection because it happens all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a writer named Alan Gurganis. He wrote The Oldest Living Confederate, The Widow. Mm-hmm. You might remember the book when it came out last year. He was telling me that in 1975, through the efforts of John Cheever, he sold a story to The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, man, I'm off and running. My first story, my first sale. That was the last story he sold to the New Yorker or anybody else.
Uh-huh.
He said over the years, while he was working on this novel, his life has been one of weekly rejection slips and mounting bills in his mailbox.
Well, I have plenty of bills. I could maybe pass along some of the bills to him. But I don't know. I attempted to sell. I've been writing since I was 9 years old. And I never really attempted to sell a lot of material. I did at some point decide after my friends kept saying, hey, you should try to sell some of your material. I did try to sell some short stories, and I haven't yet to sell a short story. In fact, West of Paradise Run is the first sale I've actually had. I've been published in other publications, but this is the first real piece of work that I've actually sold.
Well, let's talk about West of Paradise Run, and your hero is Jonathan Frederick Shelby, who is a black sergeant in the Union Army.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a real Jonathan Shelby?
Not a real Jonathan Frederick Shelby. However, there were plenty of black soldiers in the Civil War, up to 200,000 as the count goes. There weren't very accurate records kept in 1865 and the war years 1861 to 1865. But there were about 200,000 soldiers in the war, and they weren't allowed to join up until 1862. And this story about John Shelby, it's a historical fiction story, and which makes it interesting. A lot of the black history that I, and just regular history that I have in the book, a lot of people don't know about. A lot of people have no idea that they were black soldiers or black cowboys. But what West of Paradise Run does is to bring that into perspective. And once I got into doing the research, which took me about 2.5 years, I found that one book would not tell the story. So there are 6 books in the series. This is just book one.
200,000 black soldiers, were they all in the Union Army?
They were all in the Union Army. There were none in the Confederacy. There were slaves that were taken into the Confederate ranks and forced to do work for the Confederate soldiers. However, as soon as they got a chance to get away, they fled and went to the Union lines. There were several, many, I should say, black spies who actually were Union soldiers or Union affiliated, and they would masquerade themselves off as just being a slave, and they would cross into the Confederate lines and get intelligence information, and then go back, put on their uniforms, and go back to the Union Army and tell, of course, the general or whatever exactly what was going on, the soldier count and so forth. And that was something that I didn't know 5 years ago, something that I just found out in doing my research.
Now, you mentioned the black cowboys. How did blacks become cowboys?
Well, actually, a lot of the black cowboys were once soldiers. There were some who just, some black men who decided they wanted to move away from the East, from the black codes, from the bigotry and the racism. So they moved west, as far away from Tennessee and Georgia and Alabama as they could. So they ended up in Texas in many cases because there were always some jobs in Texas to do, namely running cattle up north. So some of the soldiers who finished out the war and the soldiers who retired eventually became cowboys because it was ready work. It was hard work, but at least it was work, and that's what the black soldiers wanted, or the black cowboys wanted.
Now tell me about John Shelby. He's on a mission for his commanding officer. What happens to him?
John Shelby is a soldier scout for the U.S. Army. Being a scout may not mean that much these days, but to be a scout means that you have to go ahead of the pack, of the battalion, in order to find out exactly what the terrain was and where the enemy might be. John Shelby had the job of basically traveling alone most of the time. And in this particular book, West of Paradise Run, he travels from New Orleans into Red River Station, Texas, or into the Red River area. He ends up in Clarksville, Texas, where he runs into some men who actually kill his partner. And he vows revenge to get them back. However, along the way, he determines that there's more men than he can really handle. However, he waits until dark, and as they try to ambush him, he ambushes them and takes the three prisoners, and he takes them to the nearest town of Clarksville, Texas, in order to see that they get a fair trial.
Or he's not warmly greeted.
Not warmly greeted at all. In fact, the people in the town were afraid of chains. That was the main thing. And when they saw a black man in a Union blue uniform, that was too much for them. But they really didn't want to do anything to him because they did have respect for a uniform, even though it was the uniform of the enemy. So this town, Clarksville, Texas, had been taken over by the Union Army. So there was very little that people could do officially. However, at nighttime, of course, for the most part, the Union soldiers, the Union generals and the people in charge, whenever they went to bivouac or went to bed, well, then if there were other soldiers out on the street, well, then they stood to be attacked. And namely, John Shelby came through being so different as he was. He was attacked and had quite a few problems along the way.
Yeah, every chapter is a cliffhanger because he has so many brushes with death. What have you pretty well blocked out what's going to happen to Shelby in the future books?
Pretty much. In book two, which is called Shelby's Ghost, John Shelby had decided, actually, that he wanted to get out of the military. However, at the end of the book, West of Paradise Run, I won't exactly say what it's about, but he does get a raise in rank. He does become a lieutenant. So that's an enticement for him to stay in. Plus, he had a chance to lead his own brigade of black fighting men along the Rio Grande. So he's headed toward San Antonio and toward the Rio Grande in order to hit up these soldiers. So he runs into a lovely Mexican woman and runs into, I guess you could say, a future employer who owns a large ranch, and he saves the daughter of the ranch owner, and therefore he's offered a job as a cowboy once he finishes his Union Army duties. And so he's actually on his way to becoming a cowboy in book two. Book three, he actually takes those fighting men along the Rio Grande, and they fight General Riff Raff and Desperados, Mexican Indians, and black men who are just plain renegades.
General Riff Raff, was he on the Confederate side, or are they?
No, not at all. He was very happy to be fighting for the Union Army. He was proud of that Union blue on his back. And he was also proud of the rank, of course. The rank of sergeant, first of all, was something that just really wasn't given to a black man in those days. And when he got a chance to become a lieutenant, that was, you know, even better. And he always sought to gain freedom for not only himself, but for his family and his people. And he figured the best way to do it would be to fight in the war and to fight these people who were trying to take over the territory. In book four, which is called The Big Bold Sky, John Shelby actually does become a cowboy. And he runs cattle up from through the Texas Trails, the Chisholm Trail, and the Great Western Trails, and so forth. He runs them into Ogallala and into Dodge City and cattle towns like that. In the next installment, the fifth installment, John decides he wants to bring his family west. So he has spent some time fur trapping and just kind of hanging out in the Colorado area and the Rocky Mountain area, and he hits a streak of gold that someone hasn't found. So he gets the gold together and is able to bring it back to the nearest town. He sells the gold, gets the money, and plans to bring his people from Tennessee, from the east, toward the west. However, trains are running now, and so he brings them back on the train. However, they are attacked by some Indians and some other marauders, some Border Patrol people who have nothing good in mind. So he has to defend the train and get them back safely to Colorado. So once he does that, well, then that episode ends, and then he finally ends up in Los Angeles area, a place called Aldeanus, which he actually decides that's going to be his Paradise Run. Paradise Run, the name, is a place where he figured that he could move himself, his family, and just have a group of people that were ready to live and live in peace. He was tired of the bigotry and the racism and the hatred, so he figured people of all races, it didn't matter what race they were, as long as they were ready to live in peace. And that town is full of riffraff, as you might expect. And
general riffraff.
General riffraff. And desperados and killers and thieves. He comes in. He's made the sheriff of the town. He rids the town of all of the desperados. And he's voted in to be mayor. So he becomes mayor of the town and eventually decides to change the name of the town to Paradise Run. And so that is the story in six parts.
Well, you really have blocked this out, haven't you?
Well, I had to. You know, it's writing a book is something that I never thought I would do. And even writing West of Paradise Run, it was my ninth book. I still had no idea of how to write a book. I just decided I would try to tell a good story. And I think I've done that in West of Paradise Run. And I realized there were so many different aspects of the soldier that I wanted to bring about that it took at least five more books to do it. Plus, I might add that because of the way book companies are set up, when you mention to them one book, they're not as excited as when you mention six books. So six books sounded so great and wonderful that they decided that they wanted to publish them all.
Has Ballantyne set you on some sort of deadline or schedule?
Not really. Actually, I was just told a few days ago that they wanted to see book two. Publishing works so slowly. In radio, I'm always accustomed to going out, doing a report, getting it on the air within the hour. TV is basically the same way, but in publishing, it's more like on a quarter basis. There are four quarters in a year, and if you don't make it for the first quarter of the year, well, you just think about the second quarter, the third quarter, the fourth quarter. And they are very slow in their dealings, and I can pretty much stay ahead of them. However, they're the type of business where all of a sudden it's like hurry up and wait. You know, hurry up and get it together. And then, you know, you have to wait for them to make a decision, whether it's 2 months, 3 months, or 6 months.
Yeah, publishing is really an old-fashioned form of communication.
Mm-hmm.
It's archaic when you think about it. And they have to proofread these things and bind them, and then they have to truck them to distribution centers.
Yeah, that's a long process that goes through it. And I'm glad I went through it. You know, it was the first time I had a chance to go through anything that was this drawn out. And although I had control over writing the book, it was very difficult to give the book to someone, and then 8 months later, still they're still saying, "Well, we hope your book will be out soon." You know, as if they have no idea when the book is going to come. But there are a lot of people they have to deal with, a long chain of command, as you know, that has to approve the book, and it has to be proofread by five or six different people. The facts have to be checked, and so forth. And I think this book is being a historical Western. They really had to do some checking because a lot of these facts in there were very difficult for me to find and almost impossible for them to verify.
You know who would make a great Jonathan Shelby for the movies?
Oh, who?
Danny Glover.
Danny Glover. Exactly. I've been every time people see the book, they say, "That looks like Danny Glover." However, it's not Danny Glover, but
he
would be perfect for the book. In fact, I have talked with his agent, and we're supposed to get together at some point, but it's so very difficult for him to find time. He's doing a lot of films, and I'm trying to work a full-time job as an anchorman and push the book at the same time. So I'm on the talk show circuit doing what I call a full-time job, working on another book as well, on a broadcaster, on an autobiography, which is my first nonfiction book. And so it's just a lot of things that I'm trying to do, and I really need to be able to move around to be mobile. However, that's kind of difficult to do when you're working 5 to 5 days a week at a full-time job.
No, you've got a lot of irons in the fire, and it's tough having a full-time job and trying to write. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I try to do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when my weekend comes up, I know I feel guilty sometimes. I should be writing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I just don't feel like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's when what comes from the heart is what means a lot. There have been many times I'm sitting at my computer at 3 in the morning, my eyes are closing, and I'm trying to type, and I'm a terrible typist as it stands. However, I always manage to get something done on paper. I try to do at least if one line, one word, one line is great. It's better than nothing. And there's some days that I can write page after page. In fact, on sunshiny days, I may write 3 pages, 4 pages, but on rainy days, I could write a chapter, 2 chapters, 3 chapters, 4 chapters. And that's amazed me, but it just seems that whenever it rains or when it's cloudy or whatever, the ideas start flowing, and I try to find a way to get off from work.
Yeah, I'm kind of like that, too. There are some people who say they can write a page a day or X number of words per day, and I find that I need longer periods of time to write.
Mm-hmm.
I could write 14 hours, 15 hours. I'm not sure that's a good way to do it because you get tired.
Well, I think you have to just write what you feel and when you feel. You know, there have been times when I had an appointment at 9 o'clock in the morning. I would get in at midnight or 1 o'clock and have such a great idea. There's just no way that I could go to bed and be rested for the morning appointment. But I've even found that even doing that, even if I did write from 1 o'clock in the morning till 6 and lay down and get a 30-minute nap, I'd wake up refreshed because I'd done what I needed to do. I'd gotten the material written, and above all, in the bottom line, was that I got the material written. And I find oftentimes that the more fatigued I am, the better my material comes out.
I got myself a little laptop computer I carry around with me.
Mm-hmm.
Usually not today, but usually I carry it around. And usually on weekends when I work here on the desk, I keep it next to me. And if mm-hmm. I have some ideas and it's quiet, and often it's very, very quiet on Sunday afternoons when we have a ball game, you know, I'll sit there and write into my laptop. And mm-hmm. then when I get back home, I can plug it into my Macintosh
mm-hmm.
and dump it into the Macintosh.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can, you know, do some stringent editing and spell checking and things like that.
Right.
Uh-huh. When are you going to get that Mac? With all the money you're making on Western Paradise Run.
No money yet. That's the thing. No money yet. You know, they give you a little bit of money up front and say, okay, go with it. And then it takes them a year to send you that small amount of money. And actually, my agent told me when she handed me the first book, my editor actually, it said, well, don't expect any money anytime soon. You'll get a royalty check. Now, this was, November of last year. She said, well, expect a royalty check December of 1990, first of 1991. And when it comes, you know, be happy, but don't look for it, because you know, it will not come in a speedy fashion.
Well, I sold a novel to St. Martin's Press in 1988, and I got an advance for it. And the book sold about 4,000 copies. Mm-hmm. And last week or week before, I got a royalty statement, and on paper, I owe them money.
You owe them money?
On paper, I owe them money, because I don't think the book earned its advance.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so on paper, I think I owe them $1,500.
Oh, no.
you don't have to pay your advance back to them.
Oh, right, right.
But they show how many books were sold and uh-huh. how much the earnings were and, mm-hmm. and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So sold about 4,000 copies, but that really, mm-hmm. and it had a first printing of, it had the only printing of 5,500 copies.
Oh, I see.
Uh-huh. And so I got a letter from them last week saying they had 900 copies left,
mm-hmm.
and I could buy them at no more than a dollar each.
Uh-huh.
And what I don't buy, they will auction to a remainder house.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So I bought 50 copies. I think I could score
good.
That many
right.
in Manhattan apartment.
Right.
Well, it's a wonderful feeling, though, isn't it, to see the fruits of your labor? What was it like when she handed you this first copy?
Well, it was
anticlimactic.
It was really. You know, it you work on something for a long time, and then you give it to someone else, and you basically forget it. I'd read many times from authors, especially John Gardner, who I read a lot of his nonfiction material about writing, and he said, submit the book to your agent or to your editor and forget it. And I could never picture submitting all that work to someone and just forgetting it. But I did see what he was saying, and I actually forgot it because it took them a long time to come to actual publication. So, and plus I have other books that I was working on too. I went right into an autobiography I'm doing of black broadcaster Mal Good, who was the first black to do TV and radio broadcasting for ABC News back in the 1960s. So I have a contract with him. We're working on his autobiography. In fact, any day now I'm expecting to hear from several book companies about whether they want to publish the book or not. But it seems that five companies were very much interested. The editors there know of his work, and I don't think there'll be any problem. So that should be a decent advance, and hopefully they'll get that into a publication in a speedy fashion. Mal Good is 83 years old, going on 82 years old. And he's still very active, but I can tell that the biggest dream of his life now would be to have a book in his hand to take around to all of the places where he speaks and so forth. So it's like I moved from one book straight to another one and kind of really did forget West of Paradise Run. Because if you think about something like this every day, as you know, time goes very slowly. And you keep thinking, well, you know, one of these days I'll hear. And then the day that you forget about it, seems like this is the day when they contact you and say, well, success, you know.
Well, you mentioned John Gardner. An interesting thing about him, and when he had been writing for 10, 12, 15 years, all of his books were rejected over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden he sold a book called The Resurrection, and it was his first published novel. And the editor said, do you have any other work? And Gardner said, you bet I do. He had about six or seven books, mm-hmm. and they were all published.
Mm-hmm.
So they were published annually. Each mm-hmm. book came out the following year.
Mm-hmm.
But he had written them long before The Resurrection.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that's probably what will happen with the books that I've written, the other books. I usually spend a lot of time writing the first draft. However, as you know, you have to go back and rewrite the book, you know, go through and edit it, what I call a rewrite, because there are many things that you say in the book that may not be what you wanted to say, and you have to just keep going back through it word for word and do your edits on it. I must have gone through West of Paradise Run at least 25, 30 times to make sure everything was correct. One of the things I did that was very good for me, and that is to do the historical research, and whenever I did write down something that was historical, I made sure that it was fact. So that I wouldn't come back a year later and attempt to go through and try to determine, well, was this factual or was it not? You know, I did know once I got the book finished that what parts were fiction and what parts were fact, and that was very important.
Elmore Leonard used to write paperback westerns before he turned to mysteries. He said one of the most helpful research tools that he found was Arizona Highways, the magazine.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it showed photographs of the lay of the land, the cactus, it described mm-hmm. the cactus and the names and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
He said he collected all these Arizona highways,
uh-huh.
and he said they were wonderful because he had never been in Arizona.
Yeah, right.
And it gave him mm-hmm. all of this detail. It was mm-hmm. it's a good thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, J.J., I congratulate you for getting this book published, and going to look forward to the other ones, and particularly I'm going to look forward to Danny Glover
mm-hmm.
and the movie.
Yeah, well, I hope I can talk to him and talk him into it. But I hear he's looking for westerns to do, especially black westerns. And as far as I know, this is the only black western out there.
This is the one.
This is the one.
Congratulations.
Thanks a lot, Doc.
Hang on, JJ.